Support for this podcast comes from Washington Wise, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington affect your portfolio and your money every day. But what policy changes should investors be watching? Washington Wise is an original podcast for investors from Charles Schwab. The show unpacks the stories making news in Washington and how they may affect your finances and investments. Listen today at schwab.com/washingtonwise. That's schwab.com/washingtonwise.
From pesos to pounds, euros to yen, Wise can help you manage your money in different currencies. With Wise, you can send money to your cousin in Australia in seconds. Travel internationally without having to brave an airport currency exchange desk or take the guesswork out of converting currencies. Wise lets you send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate, all without any hidden fees. Join 60 million customers already using Wise worldwide. To learn more about how a Wise account can work for you, download the app or visit Wise.com. That's Wise, W-I-S-E.com. Wise.com.
Hi, my guest today is Jennifer Cates. She's a Senior Vice President and Director of Global Health Policy at the Henry J. Kaiser Family Foundation. She's been involved in numerous global health issues and antivirus issues for years and years and years. I spoke to her, of course, about the COVID-19 pandemic and the options that are going to be facing the Biden administration as they take office in January. It's an odd time to be changing over administration, sort of midstream through vaccine distribution. So we talk about vaccine logistics, the science of that, some of the different questions that they'll be facing on a policy level, how you coordinate with states, but also about other measures which are going to continue to be relevant through the early months of a Biden administration, what he can do there to help maintain a sort of sustainable equilibrium. And then we turn to the global picture as well in terms of how can we help make sure that these vaccines go worldwide and really create a safe and healthy environment for everybody. I mean, this is the question that's been on my mind for weeks and weeks is what's Biden going to be able to do with the vaccine? What are we going to do? What are we going to do? I learned a lot. I think you learned a lot. And it ends on an optimistic note that actually, for the first time in a long time, made me feel better about the COVID-19 outlook. So enjoy. Hello, welcome to another episode of The Weeds on the Vox Media Podcast Network. I'm Matthew Iglesias. I'm here today with Jennifer Cates. She's Senior Vice President at the Kaiser Family Foundation and a person I know also in real life through our kids are in the same grade at the same elementary school here. So one of the first people I spoke to about the COVID-19 pandemic before it was a topic of dominating news interest. So, you know, we're talking about the next 4 years here on this this series of episodes. But when it comes to the pandemic, I mean, I think the next 4 months are what's really urgently on people's minds. And I think that starts with vaccine, which we are hoping vaccines will be approved very, very soon. But then there's the question of what do you do with them? How do you distribute them? How do you get them out? And that seems like it's going to be the Biden administration's job number one, right?
Definitely. And hi, it's good to be here and see you not on the playground. I think the number one task that the Biden administration is going to be faced with is getting the vaccine or vaccines to as many people in the United States as possible and as quickly as possible. And it's going to be the biggest undertaking of this kind ever. So it's no small feat. And the new administration is going to be coming in, having to hit the ground sprinting. And there's going to be a lot of challenges. I mean, I don't want to skirt over. There's a lot of great things, too. The science is really positive. But in terms of getting a vaccine to people, that's going to be a challenge.
And so we have a lot of experience with vaccines, but actually not with a rollout of this kind. Because when polio or measles, when those vaccines were developed, these were endemic diseases. A lot of people had already had them. So it wasn't this kind of race, right? Like how can you get 300 million doses out in as quickly a span as possible? It's a really sort of an unprecedented public health mission that the world's governments have given themselves here.
It really is. I mean, it's not that we can't learn lessons from those other experiences. Certainly, they were challenges, and they still remain challenges in other countries. But yeah, nothing like this. I mean, even H1N1 provides some lessons from 2009, but it's not it's not the same. So this doesn't really have a historical example that we can look at and say, aha, that's how we did it. And I would argue that, you know, there's a lot more complexity now as well.
So how does it work? Who is we when we talk about this? Like,
we.
Who's actually in charge of vaccines? I mean, these are
private
companies make them. I mean, our kids get vaccinated when we go to the pediatrician. I get my flu shot at CVS. Like, who has the COVID-19 vaccines? Like, how does this work?
Yeah, so there's a lot to unpack there. And it's different than what you and I think of as like routine vaccination, where we go to, you know, the pharmacy, get our shots, which is its own system that is complicated as well. But it is, you know, sort of a well-oiled system. And in that, but what's important to know is even in that system, a lot of what happens gets decided both by states and local jurisdictions and by the companies. And yet now we're in a pandemic, and we're talking about an unprecedented race on the science side. That's quite an amazing story and a good one. But in that case, what's happened is the federal government has gone into relationships with several vaccine manufacturers. In some cases, funding their actual research and development, but in some cases not. But in all of the cases of the vaccines that we keep hearing about, the federal government is paying in advance for doses. And basically is buying, you know, sort of betting on these manufacturers to find something, and then we'll have a certain amount available. Then what happens is a complicated dance between federal government helping to manage a distribution process around the country in some cases, but in others, the vaccine manufacturers shipping directly to private entities. What is going to happen or supposed to happen that I think will be one of the biggest challenges is that the states have been asked to manage the assessment of who should get vaccinated first, how much allocation will they need over time, monitoring that, reporting back to the federal government. And while states are typically do that for routine vaccination, that is not the same in a pandemic.
Right. So in routine vaccinations, it's like different states have different rules, right? Like you get your vaccination checklist for schools or something
exactly.
like that. But they're not doing emergency prioritization in the same
Correct.
way.
This is a very unusual, right? So states have a lot of leeway in terms of deciding, and that's the way public health works. Is states decide, you know, in our state, we're going to let this particular provider vaccinate kids, and in our city, we're going to have school requirements that look like this. Those kinds of things. In this case, there's a little bit of that, but there's sort of this tension between how much are states going to be given that leeway versus what should the federal government's role be in distributing a vaccine during an emergency. When frankly, as we've seen all throughout this, the idea that each state does its own thing doesn't really work when you have an infectious disease that's spreading, right? It's just not how you combat a pandemic. You don't sort of say, well, good luck everybody out there, all 51 jurisdictions, when you go to test. Hopefully you have enough tests and enough lab capacity. We don't want to do that with vaccines.
Well, and since the federal government has paid for the vaccines, they, at least at a high level, have to allocate the doses between the states, I would imagine, right? Even if you say it's 100% up to Rhode Island to decide what you do with them.
Yes.
Like, how much does Rhode Island get?
Right. So that is a good question. So what the federal government has said, and I would say that the federal government has moved very quickly on the vaccine side, differently than it has on testing and contact tracing, although that was, you know, maybe that's not the fair comparison because that was so slow. But on the vaccine side, the federal government has said that it's letting the regular systems that recommend prioritization, and in this case, it's an advisory committee of the CDC has, that will be deciding based on the characteristics of the actual vaccines that are close to approval, what the priority should be. The reason there's going to be a priority, the reason you and I are probably not going to get a vaccine right away is because A, there's not going to be enough doses right away. And B, this is going to be a very complicated rollout. So there has to be some prioritization. The first thing that's going to happen is this committee, which is meeting tomorrow, by the way, emergency meeting. And so by the time this comes out, we may actually know who's on that priority list. We have a good idea. Then the federal government has said they're going to take the total number of doses that they have at a given point in time and allocate it by based on state population. So there could have been a lot of different ways that they decided to allocate it. They went with a very simple, transparent way, which is, you know, Rhode Island, your share of the adult population is this. That's the share of the vaccine you're going to get.
Right. I guess
that's
the
how
more
they're going to do it.
The more sort of mathematically complicated way to do it would be to say, okay, well, first, this is our high priority population.
Yes.
And then we're going to allocate based on how many high priority people there are in there. Because we know, I mean, the different states have very different demographic profiles. There's like a lot of old people in Florida and Pennsylvania,
right.
A lot of kids in Utah. I mean, I guess the advantage of doing it this way is it's easier to explain to people.
It's easier to explain. States have a very, you know, one of the things states said, and we can talk about it because we looked at their plans at KFF, states were wanted predictability.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they wanted to understand how much they're going to get because they're trying to prepare. So that helps. And yes, it's transparent. It's easy to understand. The problem, as you said, is the populations that need this are not distributed evenly.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're talking about healthcare workers or older individuals, so this is where I think a Biden administration will have to think about, you know, how heavy a hand does it have in assuring that kind of equity?
So, we should talk about how do we think about prioritization? You're an expert. I, like most people, before this March, all my information about pandemics came from the movie Contagion, in which they distribute it by a birthday lottery, which makes
yes.
for good drama. Because you can have it on television. I guess that doesn't make that much sense, right? So to me, just looking at, you know, what's happened over the past several months, it seems like first you want to vaccinate people who actually work in the healthcare sector.
Mm-hmm.
Because
yes.
if they can stay healthy, they can actually save lives.
Exactly.
And there doesn't seem to be any disagreement about that.
Right.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But then next, you could think about, well, who are the people who are the most at risk of serious illness, which mm-hmm. I guess would be people in nursing homes.
Correct.
Or you could think about, well, who are the people who are most at risk of actually contracting the virus and spreading it to others,
right.
which
right.
might be the people working in retail stores.
Right.
Or restaurants, something
right.
like that. And that seems like a tougher, I don't know, like not actually knowing anything about it. I could sort
yeah.
of argue it either way, right?
Yeah.
Like, is this what the advisory committees are here for? That's what you hash out?
Yeah, so what they have to do is look primarily at two kinds of factors. One is what you started to go into, which is who's at risk of getting really sick? And then I'll talk about contracting the infection in a minute, but who's at risk of getting really sick? And then what are the candidates that are there? Because some candidates have not been tested in all of the populations we may want them to be tested in. So, for example, none of the candidates have been tested in kids yet. Pfizer just started 12 and up, but that data is not available yet. So kids are not going to be initially in the groups that get vaccinated. So that we know. But then there's this harder question. Now, the vaccine candidates that are really promising, and actually most of them that are being tested, the first thing that they're looking at is, can our vaccine prevent somebody from getting symptomatic COVID disease? And can it prevent somebody from getting really sick? They haven't yet been able to measure, does it prevent transmission of the infection. So that's one. Secondly, I think because of the need to allocate a fixed dose in the beginning, they really are going to say healthcare workers, then people who are very high risk of dying or being very, very sick, which is long-term care residents and their staff, people with certain underlying health conditions. And then you get into this other, you know, well, who's next? Is it other essential health workers? So other essential workers,
mm-hmm.
you know, teachers, maybe people that you know run essential businesses. Where do they get in line? And then also the elderly, because we know that mortality rates are so much higher. So the committee that is looking at this, and they've been pretty transparent too. They've posted a ton of materials on their website. This is exactly what they're doing. They're going through and saying, should it be healthcare workers, then long-term care residents, then older people, or should it be, you know, that's what they're going to meet about tomorrow. They're supposed to come out with a recommendation on this, is that tomorrow being December 1st for those listening at whatever date.
But so you and I, the kind of the Zoom class,
right?
We are at the end of the,
we're at the end.
At the end of the line here.
Yeah, we are. But that's okay. I mean, I think, you know, we have to reach those who are getting sick, prevent them from getting sick, and allow people that are, you know, really essential in the true sense of the word to get, you know, fix the situation and save people's lives and run the essential businesses that are needed. And then the idea too is while we're waiting, that is going to bring down, the virus is transmission is just going to start to decrease too. Over time, as we start to, continue measures to prevent transmission, combined with herd immunity, that's going to start to build up. So, but yes, we, you and I are, I know, maybe next summer it'll be time for us to get vaccinated, maybe earlier.
So this is a question I had. So I know doctors like to be cautious about things that have not been specifically experimentally tested. And right. So with this vaccine, we don't have trials that demonstrate, talking about the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccines, they have strong demonstrated efficacy in terms of preventing people from developing symptoms.
Right.
They haven't tested, do they prevent transmission?
Right.
But in terms of, we must have some general knowledge of viruses and vaccines.
Yes.
Is it a common problem that a vaccine successfully stops the development of symptoms, but you still transmit it? Or would that be a kind of I mean, you can't rule it out until you test it,
right.
but would that be like a weird finding?
No, actually, there's a lot of vaccines like that.
Oh, man.
But the point is that they work really well. They work enough to bring down, to create situations where the virus is not able to live in the same way. And so it's not, people have get immunity. So if you get the vaccine and it helps you because you're not getting sick, you also gain immunity to the illness. There's less susceptible hosts in the community. And that creates the herd immunity that we need.
So the transmission would decline either.
Because of that.
So even if you're, I don't know, somewhere along the line, we'll have 30, 40% of the population vaccinated. And, and you would expect that to start
to see that.
To start bringing to down transmission.
Definitely. Definitely. And right. That's the beauty of vaccines. And, you know, there's other vaccines like that. A lot of vaccines that we do take, polio, for example, it doesn't actually stop the transmission of the virus. It just stops people from getting sick. And that is, you know, there's vaccines that do stop the transmission, but not all do. And that's just, it depends on the complication of, you know, how the actual target, the types of vaccines being used. I think with the case of Moderna and Pfizer, the specific platform that they're using, there's a lot of optimism that it will reduce risk of transmission. We just don't have the data yet.
Right, but that's because they know something about the biological mechanism.
Yep. That exactly.
It attacks some protein or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I don't know. Protein is beyond my scope of competency. So this will be starting probably. I mean, this will be starting before the inauguration, right?
Correct.
As long as things go well. So, but the question facing the new administration, I guess, will be that kind of how do you expand the rollout? And then also a question I have is how do you think about the sort of social distancing and other business restriction measures when you're in an interim kind of state? Because we know there has been a lot of political, you know, pushback, right?
Yeah.
So there's some kind of, you know, public health idealism, which would say, okay, everybody's got to stay safe, right?
Hunkered down until everyone's vaccinated.
Right, all the way through.
Right.
But at the same time, when you have, you know, some governors like don't want to do mask mandates in the middle of a huge catastrophe, I feel like once vaccines start rolling, there's going to be a lot of pressure to let things open up, to let, you know, mm-hmm. let the 20-somethings have their house parties, right. To let the restaurants open their doors fully, get the concerts back going. And like, what's your thinking on how to sort of balance that in a reasonable way?
Yeah, I think, and it does need to be balanced because I think, you know, the vaccines are the light at the end of the tunnel here. That's what we're hoping to get to, back to a sense of normal life. It may be different than we remember it, but that's okay. I think the goal, and I think the not overly optimistic hope, is that businesses will be open and people will be returning to regular activities. I think there'll be some things that will, for much longer, we'll be cautious about, very large gatherings, for example, indoors. I think masks will be an intervention that will be used for a longer period of time. But, you know, maybe the way to address this, and this is, we can get to the Biden team, because I think this is going to be their responsibility, but convincing enough people, and we know this is going to be a really tough thing because of people's feelings about vaccines for a range of reasons, that this vaccine is going to protect you and others, and get us back there. And the, you know, the mask mandates and those kinds of things are going to be important, but not on a forever basis. And I do think we're going to start, it's going to be a calibration. I think there's going to be a lot of focus on getting schools open, as there should be already. But yeah, the idea that businesses are going to have to be closed for a long, I don't think that's where we're headed at all. And I think, right, it's hard to talk about it right now because in many communities we're seeing rates rise and things are closing again. But this, it will not stay like this. And one of the things that the Biden administration will have to do, and I think they can, is communicate really clearly and really consistently to the public. Clearly, consistently, and often to the public, which is frankly not what we've had thus far. No. And that has caused a lot of confusion. It has caused the fact that, you know, states do have authority to make rules and regulations for their populations in health, but it's caused this patchwork and the politicization. And there has to be a way around that. And I think the administration could find ways to have a much stronger, helpful voice on where we're headed.
Okay, let's take a break, and then I want to follow up on that helpful voice.
Support for The Weeds comes from Not Another Politics Podcast from the Harris School of Public Policy. With the constant news cycle, there's a lot of noise out there. Opinions are plastered all over social media, pundits are throwing out hot takes without any sort of context, and it's only getting worse as we dive farther into election season. We know that if you're listening to us at The Weeds, you're looking to cut through all this. And if you like this show, you might like Not Another Politics Podcast. Not Another Politics Podcast is produced by the University of Chicago Harris School of Public Policy. They want to take a research and data approach to analyzing hot button issues and offer perspectives that go beyond the headlines. They cover a wide variety of topics in their episodes, but a few recent episodes that you can listen to include a deep dive into why women are underrepresented in U.S. politics or whether or not we can believe political surveys. You can listen and subscribe today at harris.uchicago.edu/NAPP. That's N-A-P-P. Support for The Weeds comes from Mint Mobile. Some might say that sauce is what makes us a proper society. Like, imagine a world without hot sauce, or barbecue sauce, or Worcestershire sauce, or however it's pronounced. It's inconceivable. Well, Mint Mobile agrees, and their secret sauce is that they sell their wireless service totally online. They don't worry at all about retail costs, and they say that lets them pass those savings on to you. It's why their premium wireless plans start at just $15 a month. With Mint Mobile, you could say goodbye to an overpriced monthly phone bill or unexpected fees. All of their plans come with unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed 5G data. Signing up is super easy, and you could even bring your own phone and phone number with you to your new plan when you switch. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, you can go to mintmobile.com/weeds. That's mintmobile.com/weeds. You could cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/weeds. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
So the vaccine is obviously a huge deal. It's what everybody is focusing on. But come late January, there's all this other stuff is still going to be in the mix. And I know you've been working on what can the new administration do sort of, you know, in the executive branch authority over public health that might be helpful or hasn't been done already or just needs to be renewed. So can you explain to people some of that, what you've been looking at?
Yeah, sure. So so the new administration is going to come in. January 20th will be inauguration. And then they'll be, you know, dealing with, as we keep reading about and hearing about, you know, potentially a Congress that's not going to want to be that cooperative. So what can they do? There are a number of things that they can do without Congress. For example, one thing that we've heard a lot about is the Defense Production Act. Remember that? DPA, which is an authority that the executive branch has to call upon and basically get private manufacturers to manufacture more things that are needed in crises. And President Trump has invoked it, but many have said he's not done it enough. And we still have PPE shortages in the United States.
Right, so he used it for ventilators.
He used it for ventilators, and it worked in that regard.
And then has not really gone much beyond that.
No.
And I know, so you talk about manufacturing PPE for healthcare workers as a possibility there?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's a range of things when there's supply shortages that could be dealt with through the DPA, and specifically those things. And so that would be, you know, if I were them, I would do that right away. Mm-hmm. I think that's a really, it's the authority is there. It's been used already in this pandemic, but many have said it's not been used enough. Another thing that actually the new administration is going to have to do immediately, there have been a number of emergency declarations made by the Trump administration, which is what you do during an outbreak. Some of them have expiration dates, and there's one in particular actually expires on Inauguration Day. And the reason that I'm bringing that up is it sounds like, you know, arcane, you know, government bureaucracy, but that declaration actually frees up the Department of Health and Human Services to have tremendous flexibility to help people, expand healthcare options, give states a lot more flexibility to respond to the pandemic in Medicaid, also makes some provides flexibilities in Medicare, a whole range of things. Without that declaration, you can't have those flexibilities. So, you know, day one, probably, I don't know, do your oath and then renew the declaration. Renew the public health emergency declaration will be another one.
So, the way this works, right, is, I mean, the federal government spends all this money and this grants to states and this joint programs, and all the money is sort of accounted for, right, by Congress. It's like, this is money for this is money for that.
Yeah.
And obviously, when they were like, designing Medicare, there's no provision for COVID-19. That was a long time ago.
Yeah.
But so then, because they're not idiots, like the president can make emergency declarations that let you repurpose money, you know, that's appropriated or it's in the entitlement funding streams, but lets you use it for different kinds of things. It's a kind of, you know, loophole. And it's important to do it because so much healthcare spending takes the form of these Medicaid, right?
Yes.
These joint state and federal initiatives. So everything that's happening depends on renewing that flexibility.
A lot that's happening depends on renewing that flexibility. And it's been renewed several times by the Trump administration. It has a 90-day shelf life, and then you got to renew it again. It's just that it does, you know, I don't know if they specifically timed it that way, but January 20th is when it expires. So that's another one. The other thing that I think the new administration could do is put out some really early, very clear national guidelines on a range of things, whether it's vaccines and talk or guidance to states, but also more on testing and more on social distancing. Why are face masks important? To really send stronger signals throughout the country on things that we know that the federal government has been reluctant to weigh in on. And, you know, that's been because of politics. It's been because of a different view about the role of the feds and the states. But I think the new administration really has an opportunity to come in and change that dynamic.
What's the actual authority, right? I mean, the federal government can't do a mask order,
correct?
Right? That's a state thing. I mean, I guess you could apply it to airplanes or something.
Yes.
But all the airlines require it already. Yes. I mean, so that would be more symbolic, I think, than, right. than practical.
It would, and you know, maybe it's too late in the sense that it's been, unfortunately, so politicized. But I don't believe it's too late because I do think that when you start to see, I mean, think about our own neighborhood. When we all started wearing masks, it was a little odd. Uh-huh. And now it's normal. I mean, you know, now if you don't see somebody with a mask, and particularly if you're walking with your kid, you get a whole public health lecture from a five-year-old about why that person isn't wearing a mask. So I do think that if we had national leadership that was very clear about masks and why it was so critical for getting us through this, and in fact, it's an alternative to many of the measures that people don't like, mm-hmm. the closing businesses and other things. I think if we had that clear presentation of that information on a regular basis where it was very obvious and people were not made to feel bad about their choices, but to really be supported, I think it could make a difference. And that's what I, yeah, there's not the same kind of teeth. It's not a federal mandate. They can't do that, but they can do a lot to push and maybe change the psyche around this.
I do think that the future of public health may be training five-year-olds to run around and scold people because they're very, we both have five-year-olds. They're very rigid, yes. But also people respond better to being scolded by
they do.
By like cute children said, than by yeah, me.
I could be in danger if I said something, but my kid.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, no.
It's, so send them after the smokers and, you know, everyone out
totally.
There.
Totally.
That's what it's going to be. No, I mean, I do think... I mean, it's weird to me the way the mask thing has gone because it's such a low cost.
It's an accessible in public health. It's so rare, honestly, because especially since I work, my background's on HIV policy. It's so rare to have an intervention that's cheap, accessible, easy to use, and has such a big impact, like a mask. And yet, it's become this political football, which is really too bad because it works.
But also a challenging thing in, you know, you hear a lot about sort of politics and, you know, Trump fanatics or something mm-hmm. like that. But, you know, I tried to take the city bus a couple weeks ago. I figured mm-hmm. it'll be fine. You know, they're not that crowded. People are wearing masks. I had my mask on and I got on and there was a guy there and he had a mask, but he wasn't wearing it. So I said, like, you should wear your mask. And he was like, fuck you. And then, I don't know, like, I didn't know what to do. You know, like the bus driver wasn't going to make
Didn't
him do
intervene.
It. And so I just got off, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's fine. It was no big deal. But I do wonder about some of this stuff. I mean, it seems like public health relies to a fair amount on sort of suasion and social consensus rather mm-hmm. than hard enforcement mm-hmm. of these kinds of things. And I just saw today, you know, Phil Murphy, the governor of New Jersey, he was saying that 70% of people who contact tracers get in touch with wouldn't cooperate, mm-hmm. Which I assume, I mean, that can't just be partisan Mm-mm. motives
no,
in New Jersey, right? I mean, Americans don't seem super inclined to cooperate in the kind of way that I feel like we need.
Definitely. As somebody working in public health, I think about this a lot. And I you know, when dissecting all the reasons why the U.S. has done so poorly in response to this pandemic compared to some other countries, you know, there's so many factors. And one, I do think we have a very different cultural persona, sense of what it means to exist in a society than other countries do. And the idea that you do something that benefits others around you is not necessarily baked into that our sense in the same way in other countries where masks are being worn and have been worn for years. It's a big challenge. And so there's one school of thought, I wouldn't say most public health people are in this school of thought, is you know, the punitive, the stick. And that doesn't really work. You know, punishing people for not doing something in the public health sense, it backfires. I think the other is recognizing that this is a complex territory and you have to find ways to not shame people, and support them in making choices. Harm reduction is what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. And so try to help people realize that there's a lot that they can do and they have the power to do it. But there's no magic here. It's why, I mean, seatbelts is a good example of how that was a structural intervention, mm-hmm. right? Where the government basically imposed a structural fix to a problem where people were not changing behavior and it was deadly. And I'm not sure we can do that here. So it's going to be hard. I sometimes wonder if the initial mask data had been as clear that masks help the wearer, mm-hmm. that if that would have made a difference. Because remember the initial messages were wear a mask because it protects people around you mm-hmm. in case you have COVID. And, you know, I think what if it had been wear a mask because you'll be protected? We might have had better compliance in the beginning. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I thought that was an interesting, you know, faced with ambiguous information, right?
Yeah.
People have to choose what they want to say. And it was definitely clearer that it was protective to others
right.
than protective to yourself. But, you know, there was always some reason to believe that there was
totally.
A self. Frankly,
it makes
like
sense. If you think about it, you don't, you know.
If you think about the general phenomenon of wearing masks and breathing, right? Like it works in both directions. I mean, I'm not a doctor, but I have breathed. It was an interesting choice to position it primarily as pro-social. And I think that the thinking was, I mean, part of the thinking was about the data, but part of the thinking was that people felt that wearing a mask was cowardly.
Yeah.
Right. So they wanted to position it as a noble, like other oriented kind of act, which, you know, it makes a certain amount of sense. But also, like, people don't want to get sick. And just telling them, like, do this and you won't get sick, you know, could have maybe gone further. You've worked a lot in HIV/AIDS space over the years. And there's a sort of parallel situation there, right, with what sides of self-protection versus society mm-hmm. do you want to emphasize in messages? And I assume things have gone, you know, in different directions at different points in time. But it doesn't seem to have worked, at least the mask message I mean, people wear masks, but not a lot.
I think it's worked better than people know. Mm. And the data, all the data that have come out, like CDC just had a study last week or the week before showing, I forgot where it was, but in the United States where mask mandates really decreased cases. And there's study after study that show that. So, but I'm not sure that that's gotten out as much as it needs to. So I think that we've been, so what we see in that comes before our eyeballs is always around the politicization of this. And, you know, this state has a mandate that doesn't, but the data that really show this works, they're there. I mean, it's pretty astonishing how strong the correlation is. And so maybe the one of the answers is to get that information out.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Emphasize the positive. Okay. Let's take another break and then I want to come back to you.
Wyze is the app that makes using different currencies easy. Need to send dollars to your cousin in Bali fast? Getting paid in another currency and don't want to lose out because of inflated exchange rates? Want travel money without having to slog through the currency exchange kiosk? Then Wyze just might be your answer. From pesos to pounds, euros to yen, Wyze takes the guesswork out of converting currencies. You can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate with no markups and no hidden fees. In 2023, people sent over $100 billion worldwide with Wyze. What's more, over half of those transfers got to their destination in less time than it takes to listen to this ad. Whether you're traveling, spending money abroad, or doing business, let Wyze help you manage your money in different currencies with ease. Join 16 million customers already using Wyze worldwide. To learn more about how a Wyze account can work for you, download the app or visit Wyze.com. That's Wyze, Wyze.com. Wyze.com.
Vacations can be tricky. You already know how to book flights and hotels, but now the only thing you're missing is, you know, the actual travel experience. Because is it really a vacation if you're just sitting around like you would at home? You need a tool to get the most out of your time away.
That's where Viator steps in. You can book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected. And 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Because this has been such an acute problem in the United States, and you know it burdens us all. You know, I've become very sort of self-centered in a lot of my thinking. But of course, this is a global problem, and you work on global health issues, and I wonder what are the sort of prospects for, I don't know, like vaccine assistance. I mean, mm-hmm. obviously, everything that makes it hard to run a major vaccination program gets harder when you talk about countries with, you know, less transportation yeah. infrastructure, less money, fewer things like that. It's obviously not the kind of thing Donald Trump like sweats a lot. But I imagine, I mean, part of, you know, Joe Biden wants to go back to America's traditional role as a stakeholder in the world. He says he wants to rejoin the World Health Organization. Mm-hmm. How does this work when you start taking a more international view?
Yeah, so yeah, definitely 100% we will see Biden you know, stay in the WHO, be at the table for that conversation and reassert the role that the positive role that the US plays on the global stage. And you know, to some extent, that has been because there's been this sort of American tradition of it's the right thing to do, and that's what we do. But I think that's, of course, that I share that. But I think we're also dealing with a pandemic where, you know, if we truly want to end this, it doesn't make sense. Just like it doesn't make sense to get one state vaccinated mm-hmm. and not have other states vaccinated, it doesn't make sense to have a couple countries vaccinated.
Right. We want people to be able to go to Mexico and come back or
yeah,
whatever
unless
else.
We permanently and do it the right way, which most countries have never done, you know, shut everybody's borders down, which is not going to happen. It makes no sense. And it would tank the economy everywhere. And it's just not the solution. You know, we can't get out of this problem unless we achieve a certain amount, a certain share of herd immunity globally. And the vaccine is the way to do that. So many countries, in fact, just about every country, except the US, Russia is also not participated, have come together to try to solve this problem. They haven't solved it yet, but they've created something called COVAX. They're working on finding ways to make sure that those countries that have less means will have access to the vaccine. And you know, I think that's the hope there. And the U.S. will assuredly play in that world again. In terms of the challenges that will be faced with getting vaccine to people in lower infrastructure environments, I think there's been proof again and again that it can be done. So not to minimize those challenges, but I think more the bigger challenge is going to be making sure that the rich countries of the world don't buy up all the vaccine doses and then, you know, forget that they have to. It's not just a fairness issue, but it's a public health one.
So, but you think just keeping the sort of money flowing so that the doses keep rolling off the line and getting shared, that's sort of the big sticking point.
I do think that's the big sticking point. I mean, I think we have a lot of experience in delivering medications and vaccines in hard to reach areas. And so I think that can be overcome. It still will need support. The first order of business there is finding a way to get the vaccine to those countries and to everybody.
And do you think that there's going to be a significant issue, I mean, domestically or internationally, of people not wanting to take it? I mean, we were talking originally about prioritization, where the assumption yeah. is, you know, I'd like to get a vaccine, yep. you know, on December 17th, but they're not going to let me, right? Because I'm not important enough. But then you do eventually get to the other side of it, where you know, the government, right. The government wants everybody to get measles vaccines, but not everyone does. And we could have a similar problem here.
And not everyone gets the flu vaccine either. Mm-hmm. And that's one that's, you know, just, oh, by the way, we should have said this earlier, COVID vaccine is going to be free in the U.S. So that's not going to be a barrier. But the flu vaccine's free. It's recommended. It's free to those with insurance. On the other side of this, you know, just like we'll anticipate there'll be demand from people who want the vaccine but aren't yet in line, there's going to be pushback. There's lots of reasons for that. There's people that are just anti-vax, right? Mm-hmm. But they've existed for a while, so that's they're still there. Then there's just people who are going to be hesitant. This is a new thing. Can we trust the government? After everything that's happened the last few months, some anxiety around that. I've heard some people say if it's the vaccine is coming out under the Trump administration, I don't want it. Some people saying if it's coming out of the Biden administration, I don't want it. You know, so there's going to be people who are just, I don't know how many there are, but then there's people who really do have valid concerns and history with government medical interventions. And I'm speaking mostly of people of color in this country who have not a good history with that. And then just a lot of concern. This is a new vaccine. I mean, my mom, so I work in public health, and she knows that. And she keeps raising all kinds of anxieties with me about safety and should she get it. And of course, I'm going to make sure she does when she's up. But so we have to overcome that and misinformation. I mean, that is going to be one of the biggest challenges here. So yeah, on the uptake side, that's going to be hard. What's hard to know is once it gets rolled out and people start to see that things are changing and more people they know are getting vaccinated and people are talking about it, that may go a long way to change some of that hesitancy. Mm-hmm. But, that's just a hypothesis.
Yeah, I mean, I always get the sense, at least with the flu vaccine, like one reason that the take-up is not so strong is that the vaccines themselves are not that, I don't know, I was going to say they're not that potent. They're not
correct. They're not as effective as we anticipate this vaccine being.
Right. And there's a paradox, right? Because as an individual, the less effective the vaccine is, like the less inclined I am to bother to go get it, even if it's just taking some time out of my day. But the more important it is from a social perspective, right? If the vaccine is incredibly effective, then it's actually fine if 5% of people don't get it or something. But right. If it's only 70% effective, then flu has always been stuck on that, right? That it's like if everybody got this shot that doesn't work that well, we'd be in much better shape. But as you as an individual, the benefit is not that high. But here, like the good news is that these are highly, as far as we can tell, they're highly effective. So like you benefit a lot from getting it.
Yes, people will benefit a lot. And that was not predetermined that mm-hmm. that would be the outcome. And I think you and I would be having a very different conversation if the candidates so far had come out with 50% efficacy, which was the minimum mm-hmm. threshold the FDA set. Then you'd be have a whole different prospect. You'd be telling people, here's something new. You know, half the time it may help you. But
it's brand new. It doesn't work. We really want you to take it.
But we're talking the vaccines, the two main ones that are far along and are going to be available shortly, I assume, are over 90% effective or efficacious. It's kind of amazing. That's very high.
I did want to make that point because we actually, there was so much media coverage in the mm-hmm. intervening months of the prospect of this kind of low efficacy vaccine. And there was a lot of hand-wringing about had the 50% threshold been set too low and, all these other things. So it's important, I think, for people to hear the sort of the good news that these candidates didn't just like limp over the line. They really hit it.
Yeah, they hit it out of the park.
So that's very good. And people should really, I mean, on both ends, both it's like it's really good for you, but also that the social sort of herd immunity threshold is easier to clear. And also, as I understand it, obviously this virus is quite transmissible. Like this is where we are, but not as much as measles. Mm-hmm. Which, I think a lot of us, we've all read stories about relatively small anti-vax populations sparking measles outbreaks. Mm-hmm. But that has something to do with the particular characteristics of the virus.
Mostly,
as well.
Yeah. I mean, I think we're hopefully between the vaccine scale up and then practicing some social distancing for a period, we will get to that point where this is really, maybe it's going back to, maybe we'll have a routine vaccination mm-hmm. environment for this. And let's hope we don't have another pandemic in the meantime. The other thing I would say about these candidates is the side effects are very minimal. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not that, you know, people's arm may hurt and that kind of thing, but it's not like these are put you out for days right. kind of thing.
So
that's good.
There's not like a population that you would advise not get them because of side effects or anything like that.
We'll have to see what the committee that makes those decisions ultimately says, but I think we're in good shape in that regard. And, you know, there's a host of other challenges. Both the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccines require two shots. Mm-hmm. They have some storage requirements and all of those things. Those can be managed, but, people are going to have to come back for another shot.
Yeah, I mean, it's just the basic, like, social logistics of these things are hard.
Although,
something that's interesting is that these are based on a new technology for making vaccines that should maybe give us, I mean, you don't want to be too complacent about anything, but like some hope about combating viruses in general.
It's very exciting from that perspective. Yeah. I mean, I think this has been an area of research for a while that's now it's found its day, you know, and it's been shown to be very effective and has a lot of promise. So it's very exciting from that perspective. And, you know, I'd say with every horrible outbreak we've had, there's been advances made mm-hmm. in combating horrible outbreaks. So,
yeah. Ever closer to utopia.
Ever closer to combating the next horrible outbreak, at least from the scientific perspective.
That's maybe good. Not no, and the, it is. I mean, this is by far the fastest vaccine development timeline
unbelievable.
In human history. And if people, I mean, if you went back to the mid-60s and told people you could have an 8-month vaccine development timeline, right, they'd think that was crazy.
I think people had said that 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No way. That's impossible. Yet it's not.
There you go. A miracle time. Okay, so Jennifer Cates, thank you so much. But before I finally let you go, I always ask people, like, is there anything else I should have asked you about here? Last thoughts that you need to unburden yourself with?
My last thoughts are, I want to end on an optimistic note because I it's been a long haul of not feeling that way. And I do feel that way because of where we are with the development of vaccines. But you know, the next month, December, and then going into January are going to be tough. We won't really have the vaccine yet. The initial ones will be for the select people that need it, and we won't have changed administrations yet. So we just got to buckle down, you know, buckle up and be prepared, but know that this is going to turn around.
Stay safe. Be responsible.
Wear your mask.
Wear your mask. Couple months.
Wear the masks. Get some more masks.
Okay, thank you so much, Jennifer Cates. This was incredibly helpful. I learned a lot. Thanks, as always, to our sponsors on The Weeds, our producer, Jeffrey Geld, and The Weeds will be back on Tuesday.